You found it. The best place for live, local, conservative talk in the morning. The Commute with Carlson. Stimulating, entertaining, and making a difference. Here's John Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
One more sip of this nice hot cup of coffee, and then we're ready to roll. The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI, right where you need to be. Thanks very much letting me be part of your listening morning already. Go ahead, if you want to give me a shout on the Genuine Auto Glass Studio lines at 206-421-5757, outside King County, 888-312-5757. The radio legend says we're going to have some spring-like weather today. That works for me. Boy, we have a lot of stuff that we need to get into. Yeah, some real surprising stuff.
I was going to say, after today's nice weather, we're going to get back to winter tomorrow. There's going to be snow in the mountains again.
Well, we must have diversity when it comes to weather.
It's a good way to look at it, right?
Jeez, I guess. I want to spend a little bit of time. Yesterday, of course, we opened up talking about the awful mass shooting, mass murder in Buffalo, New York. We only gave passing mention to the shooting in Orange County, California, at a local church there. That was every bit as much a premeditated attack, and this deserves much more attention than it is getting. First of all, this was a church, the Geneva Presbyterian Church, where the people who worship at that particular time are Taiwan Americans or Taiwan immigrants. They're from what we call and should call more often Free China. The man who attacked them, David Chow, grew up in Taiwan, but has grown to hate his country of origin. So this man, who is 68 years old, drove from Las Vegas to Orange County. And the next day he attended a lunch held by the Irvine, California, Taiwanese Presbyterian Church. He didn't know anyone there, but he spent an hour mingling with the attendees. There were about 40 of them. Then he walked to the back of the room and chained the doors, putting super glue in the keyholes. Pulls out 2 9-millimeter handguns, which he legally purchased years ago, and 3 bags. The bags had 4 Molotov cocktail-type incendiary devices and extra magazines of ammo. And then he began firing on the 40 people he had been having a pleasant lunch with just minutes before. In the bedlam that took place, a man named John Cheng, 52 years of age, tackled him. John Cheng is a doctor. Tackling David Cho allowed other parishioners to pounce and subdue the shooter. But Dr. Cheng paid for his heroism with his life. He died. 5 others were wounded, including a 92-year-old. The local sheriff there, Don Barnes, called Dr. Cheng's heroism a meeting of good versus evil that probably saved the lives of, quote, upwards of dozens of people, close quote. David Cho is booked on suspicion of murder. Again, this is all about hating Taiwan. And, of course, those sentiments have been stimulated and animated by what is going on regarding Red China, which we need to start saying more often. Back, this is what I love about terminology back when. It was Red China and Free China. And now it's, you know, the People's Republic of China and Taiwan. Why don't we just call it what it is, okay? That's the difference between those two countries, and that is what explains the animosity. It's like a burr under China's saddle that Taiwan is not only right there offshore, an island nation with its own military, its own economy, its own government, and by the way, is a lot more prosperous than China. They're basically just a constant reminder of what China could be but isn't. And China is reportedly, and it certainly makes sense, keeping a close eye on how the world is responding to what's going down in Ukraine before deciding how to proceed with Taiwan, which they have wanted to conquer ever since the Chinese Civil War. Now, we're going back to the late 40s here. The Chinese Civil War resulted in Chiang Kai-shek, the general leading the forces against Mao Zedong, the communist, fled for Taiwan and created their own government. Their own government used to be a military dictatorship, and it basically evolved into the Democratic Republic that we see today. So the media have not spent much time or attention talking about what happened there in Orange County. I'll tell you what this kind of reminds me of, the Dylann Roof mass murder in South Carolina, where a young racist white kid wanders into an evening Bible study at an African AME church and ends up, you know, enjoying the company of the people who were very gracious to them. Most of them were senior citizen black folks. And after about 40 minutes or so, the Bible study, he steps up, stands up, pulls out a gun, and just murders them. It was all a pretext for mass murder. He didn't lose his temper. He went there to kill these helpless and lovely people. That is what David Cho did, and he was hoping to kill as many of them as possible. Now, he will probably claim that he's insane. But before we go too far down that road, let me reiterate that this is not some guy who just off the top of his head heard something on the news that drove him to go to this church and start firing randomly at people. This guy plotted this attack. He took the time to get super glue and a chain so that people couldn't get out. He took the time to construct these miniature bombs, these Molotov cocktail incendiary devices. He took the time to get extra ammunition. This was all a premeditated attack. When someone takes that much, when someone has a mind that is that orderly, where they plot out how to maximize carnage and damage, we have to think twice about whether this person is crazy, insane, nutso, or whether this person is evil. Personally, I vote for evil.
I was just going to say, can I make a vote here?
Yes.
you hit the nail on the head.
And by the way, let me also reiterate incidents like this and the one in Buffalo is why America needs a death penalty. Now, the death penalty is a state-by-state issue. Some states have it for the worst types of murder. Some have it for first-degree murder that does not reach the pinnacle of a wanton mass murder. But here's the thing. For the worst of the worst crimes, we need the death penalty. Anything less is not just. It's not just. You're making a statement that innocent lives are not worthy of the ultimate penalty for those who mercilessly, sometimes with great cruelty, take those lives.
Yeah. The New York Senator Chuck Schumer is the majority leader in the Senate. I haven't heard him say anything about calling a vote to codify a death penalty in the United States.
Right.
Interesting.
Well, I don't think we need a national death penalty.
Yeah.
I mean, we have for certain federal offenses. We do. And in fact, get this. Up in Buffalo, we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but up in Buffalo, the shooter there, and again, as you know, I don't like using names, and I mentioned
giving any more notoriety to
Orange County shooter
a sicko.
Once, and I mentioned the shooter in Buffalo once. If he is tried on state charges, he will, and he's found guilty, he'll spend the rest of his life in prison. But if he's tried on federal charges, then he can be executed.
Yeah, I think
he's found guilty.
He lives very close to the New York-Pennsylvania border, but on the New York side, traveled to Buffalo. And had he lived just a few miles away on the Pennsylvania side, what, crossed the state line in commission of this crime?
Yeah.
Would that probably bring in federal prosecution, I'm guessing?
Well, no, what they're looking at here, it wasn't so much the crossing of a state line. It was whether the civil rights angle makes the charges federal.
Yeah.
So anyway, whatever can result in his execution, if he is found guilty, is fine with me.
You say yes, I say no, you say stop.
Connected like a DC lobbyist, it's time for the social media sweep on The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI.
I'm going to guess this came off the Magical Mystery Tour album of the Beatles. It was also the song that Paul McCartney used to kick off his solo tour about 20 years ago. And hadn't stopped since. All right, radio legend Mark Christopher. Thank you very much, sir.
You're welcome.
Philip G. Van.
Little colorful sounds here on such a gray-looking morning, but it's going to get nice.
Philip J. Vandervoort III standing by with the social media sweep. What's going on, Phil?
Okay, I'm going to warn you. I'm about to give you a hot take here. It stems from a post on social media by a woke ESPN anchor and pundit. Her name is Elle Duncan. And about the Buffalo, New York mass murder, she posted the following. Just thinking about all the black folks today who are going to go grocery shopping, to church, to a restaurant, and map an exit strategy for how to get out of there just in case. This is called trauma, born of racism, and it's terrifying, and no Twitter condolences will stop it. And I subscribe to a lot of what she's saying, that idea of black Americans might find themselves in a situation where they might not feel safe, or they might think, okay, something bad could happen here.
Yeah.
I just find it a little unnerving that Elle Duncan took time to post this following the Buffalo shooting, but I bet she doesn't post anything like this when there's a story about a mass shooting in Chicago or perhaps another big U.S. city like Los Angeles, potentially Baltimore, Washington, D.C., or something like that. So I just hope that if Elle Duncan is going to post this one related to Buffalo, that she does something similarly if there's a similar situation of a mass shooting in Chicago.
Well, I tell you what, let's compare,
guessing she won't.
Well, let's compare something with something, though.
Yeah.
About a month ago, there was a shooting spree took place at a Brooklyn subway station.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. The assailant was an African-American man, and he was ranting about racism, you know, about all these racist anti-white rantings when he was taken into custody. Now, are you going to see her respond the same way? In other words, is race hatred that results in violence what's wrong? Or, again, are you just going to look at when it happens to one side?
Live, local, letting the establishment have it. Lars Larson, weekdays noon to 3, KVI, KVI.com. Feeling low, got to go, see a show in town.
Hear the jokes, have a smoke, and I laugh at the clown. Would someone want to please explain to me why a criminal with a violent past looking at charges of attacking someone in a homeless camp with an axe just got his bail cut in half? Check us out. This is Eric Johnson and Denise Whitaker.
At a time when agencies in King County are working together to cut crime, bail was lowered for a man who's accused of a frightening attack with an axe. Como's Denise Whitaker shows us how far a judge lowered that bail and the next steps in the case.
Bail for Julian Bersea Caballero slashed in half. The 43-year-old is charged with assault for attacking a man in a homeless encampment with a pole, a piece of wood, and an axe.
We dispute the allegations in the charging document and expect to be asserting a defense.
Since 2000, Washington state courts have issued over 20 warrants for the defendant's arrest.
The prosecutor in this case argued for bail to remain high, citing Bersea Caballero's criminal history with assault-related convictions. But his defense attorney argued that he has a sister and a mother in the area, so he wouldn't be a flight risk. The judge made note of all of these concerns, plus a history of recent assault charges with sexual intent and multiple DUIs, but still changed his bail.
I am going to reduce bail to $75,000 cash or bond.
Here we go again. Another liberal Seattle judge making an inexplicable decision on bail for no discernible reason.
Oh, it's the old mom and sister defense, John. Come on.
Yeah,
he's got a mom and sister. If he had a mom and sister, he wouldn't be committing these crimes except for, wait, oh, he's been committing these crimes this whole time.
Yes.
There's no material difference about mom and sister defense to get his bail lowered or that he might be a flight risk. And the judge goes, yeah, okay, fine.
So I'd like to make a suggestion to the entire news media. By that, I mean radio, TV, and print. When a judge makes a decision on something like bail or on something like sentencing, tell us who the judge is. Judges are elected officials. They are making these decisions from the bench which the voters gave them to occupy. Okay? They are sitting there in court courtesy of the voters. We need to know a lot more about judges and who they are and which judges are the most lenient when it comes to bail, and for that matter, which are the toughest. But we see this, you know, all the time in newspaper stories and in, you know, stories throughout the media where they say, well, the judge did this. Okay, the judge did do that. But it's like saying, somebody authored a very controversial amendment in the legislature, a senator. Okay, which senator? There's 49 of them. So I hope that we see this because it helps the public to know who the people are who are making this decision on their behalf. Okay, these judges are not appointed. These judges hold these positions because the voters gave them the job. I mean, some of them were appointed to fill out someone's job, but then they have to run for it. So just a few, you know, thoughts there. And while we're talking about violence in the city, did you catch Bill Maher? Bill Maher, again, is a liberal Democrat, but two things drive him crazy. The first is excessive wokeness, and the second is crime and policies that make it worse. The reason Bill Maher feels this way is that since he is a Democrat, he doesn't want Democrats to lose, but when Democrats do suicidal, idiotic things, they tend to lose. And so he's saying, you know, enough of what's going on. Here he starts. This is last Friday. He was talking about how voters are probably going to be thinking a whole lot more about crime than they are about abortion or transgender athletes or anything else come November.
And finally, new rule, if you haven't seen all the crime happening lately on your TV, it's probably because someone stole it. As we head into the midterm election season, one issue that has risen to the top of voter concerns is a general feeling these days that the social order is breaking down, that there are no more safe spaces anywhere. Street crime, home invasions, carjacking, porch pirates, medical staff attacked at hospitals, incivility at sports arenas. And I think the Grubhub driver is eating my French fries.
Now, Bill Maher could have used L.A. as an example, could have used Seattle as an example. Instead, he picks a city in between, San Francisco. Have a listen.
San Francisco in the last few years has seen 11 Walgreens and 6 CVS stores just give up and close because that town seems simply beyond law, which is heartbreaking because I, like so many people, love that city. And I don't think it's corny to admit, yes, I left my heart in San Francisco. Also, my wallet and iPhone.
And he goes beyond that. He goes beyond that when he says, hey, look, there's now an entire culture and even an entire vocabulary that didn't exist for explaining some of the consequences of all this crime in San Francisco.
Bay Area citizens have been complaining in recent years about all the human feces in the streets, but now the streets are full of something else. They call it San Francisco snow. It's glass, piles and piles of shattered glass everywhere from car windows being smashed. It's so routine to have this happen to any parked car that people purposefully leave the windows down and the glove compartment open so thieves can see there's nothing of value. Or they leave a note on the car politely assuring the thief that there's nothing worth stealing and please don't break the windows.
You know what? We've seen that movie before. Back in the early 1990s, again, when there was very light enforcement of laws for smashing and grabbing out of people's vehicles. In New York City, people began to put placards, signs, that say, nothing of value in here. People would advertise that they had nothing worth stealing. And they would write this. They'd get a magic marker and they'd write a little sign when they parked their car. That's how bad it got. And Bill Maher is actually making a, you know, a joke about this. But he said it's all about if people don't feel safe, they take it out on people whose policies are making them feel unsafe. Have a listen.
Democrats like to point out that crime has actually been worse before. Yes, true. And who gives a f**k? I'm not living before. I'm living now. In 2020, America experienced its largest annual increase in homicides ever. Assaults are up. Mass shootings are up. Voters' focus is safe streets.
Yeah. Which you would expect to be people's first priority. Look, if you have high crime, I've been saying this for years, especially, frankly, to some of my business Republican friends who think it's all about a thriving economy. I say, look, if you don't have safe streets, if you don't have safe neighborhoods, you're not going to have much of an economy. Okay? People don't shop where they don't feel safe. People won't work in a part of town where they feel they and their belongings and their vehicles are at risk. People won't participate in the economy if it means compromising their personal safety. So personal safety and low crime drives everything else. If there is no order, then you're not going to have much of an economy.
John, I've got a friend coming to town today I haven't seen in 2 years. His first question, okay, Mark, Coma Plaza, Seattle, where's a safe place to park? And getting back to, we have a good friend, Art Sanders, who just retired.
Yes.
When I first got back in the building here, I said, Art, you got that full-size van. Do you park in the building here? No, I'm over near Seattle Center. I go, how is it over there? He goes, they keep breaking in my van. So I leave my doors unlocked, the windows up, and I have a sign on my seat. Doors are open. There's nothing to steal. They still broke a window.
Wow. Well, I mean, there's the illustration of everything I've just been talking about. I didn't know that about Art. He's a wonderful, wonderful man and a first-rate broadcaster and journalist. He just stepped down and retired. He's moving to L.A. But I shouldn't say retired. He's taking on a broadcast job there. But for over 20 years.
Yeah, he's from L.A., so he's he's experienced the East L.A. scenario all through the years. He's a couple years older than us. But again, he just says, don't people read? Again, it just, and he had a nice van. It was a specialty van, I'll just say that.
No, it's one of those things that is so enraging when a crime happens to a very nice person who wouldn't think of hurting another person at all. So, no, great, great illustration. It is coming up here on 6:49, 11 minutes to 7 o'clock on the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI.
Love America. The exit is to your left. Talk Radio 570 KVI.
6 minutes to 7 o'clock on the John Carlson Show. My buddy Lars Larson, our noon to three host. Lars Larson talks about the entire Pacific Northwest, his noon to three show, but he's queuing in on Marysville, Washington. Lars, do tell.
Well, here's the concern, and I think you've brought this up already. You've got a school district in Marysville that says we're going to have clubs for kids, and you're thinking after-school organizations. Well, some of them are aimed at sexual matters like LGBTQ. And we're not talking high school kids here. We're talking elementary grades going down to kindergarten. And what's happened is the teachers have said, and they said in the story last night by Joel Moreno and Como, we decide this. And, yeah, it's nice to involve the parents, but oftentimes we can't involve them because sometimes the parents cannot know what their kids are doing. And the parents showed up at a school board meeting in force and said, hold on, you have no right to put my kid in any kind of club or organization without getting my permission. And the teachers pitched a fit about it, saying, yes, we do. You parents are narrow-minded. Your kids have a right to do things at our direction without your knowledge. Now, think about that, John. It reminds me of Terry McAuliffe, who was running for governor in Virginia, who said, you parents don't have anything to say about what we teach your kids. This is that policy brought straight into Marysville, and I bet you money it's happening in every single school district in Washington State, that the schools and the teachers believe they own your kids and you have no say. And parents should be angry about that.
Well, but it looks like the school board, which was going to pass this policy, might be backing away.
Except they've pushed it off to June 6th because they said there are legal issues and all that. But they did say at least the policy will apply kindergarten through 8th. Above 8th grade, you may not have any say, parents, unless you stand up and let these people know.
Schools have no business sanctioning clubs during school hours that they keep from parents knowing about, let alone getting their permission. Great coverage, Lars Larson.
You found it. The best place for live, local, conservative talk in the morning. The Commute with Carlson. Stimulating, entertaining, and making a difference. Here's John Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
All righty. Hour number two, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Thank you very much letting me be part of your listening day. Boy, here is a surprise. In fact, when I mentioned it to Senior Chief Executive Producer Philip J. Vandenbort III, he was shocked. But the soon-to-be Supreme Court Justice, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, remember when Stephen Breyer steps down? He was a Bill Clinton appointee. He's been on the bench for close to three decades. When he steps down, Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson will be taking his place. And she sat down for an interview with the Washington Post. There was a little bit of controversy about her appointment because, not because of her so much, but Joe Biden had pledged that he would only consider a black woman for the Supreme Court. No one else need apply for this spot on the court, which instantly made it clear, okay, is she the best choice for the job? By the way, she has plenty of qualifications for the court, but none of her qualifications was as important as her race and her gender. And then you will recall when she was asked, because of this controversy where liberal Democrats are now tongue-tied when you ask them to define what is a woman, she said, that question was asked of her, and she said, I don't know, I'm not a biologist. So, rudimentary basic science, not a strong suit either. Anyway, she sat down for an interview with the Washington Post, and she was asked about the leak of Justice Alito's draft opinion in the Dobbs abortion case that would overturn Roe versus Wade, if indeed it has majority support on the court. These demonstrations that are going on in front of the justices' homes are illegal. It is illegal for anyone to try and to protest at any judge's home, whether it's a local judge or a federal district court judge or a Supreme Court justice, because you're trying to influence their vote. And that's clearly what's going on. It's an intimidation campaign. And yet the Justice Department will not enforce the law. It'll enforce the law when people were breaking it on January 6th. They make all these arrests. No arrests for the, at times, vulgar and vocal protests at the homes of Supreme Court justices. So she was asked about it. And here is the excerpt from the interview. The question was, what was your response when you saw the draft leak of the Alito opinion? And here's her answer. Everybody who's familiar with the court and the way in which it works was shocked by that. Such a departure from normal order. Then the obvious follow-up question. Do you think it was a good thing or a bad thing? Here's Ketanji Brown Jackson's answer. I can't answer that. Then, this. What do you think about peaceful protests outside of Supreme Court justices' homes? Now, obviously, the Post reporter could have said, what do you think about the illegal protests because they violate federal law? But, again, here's the question. What do you think about peaceful protests outside of Supreme Court justices' homes? Ketanji Brown Jackson's answer, quote, I don't have any comment. Wow. Well, first of all, I think we are aware that Ketanji Brown Jackson doesn't have to worry about her home being besieged by leftist protesters now, does she? But the cowardly response to these questions is revealing. Listen to what Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas had to say about these protests at justices' homes and the impact that this leak has had on the Supreme Court itself.
And I've been in this business long enough to know just how fragile it is. And the institution that I'm a part of, if someone said that one line of one opinion would be leaked by anyone, and you would say, that, oh, that's impossible. No one would ever do that. There's such a belief in the rule of law, a belief in the court, a belief in what we were doing, that was verboten. It was beyond anyone's understanding, or at least anyone's imagination, that someone would do that. And look where we are, where now that trust or that belief is gone forever. And when you lose that trust, especially in the institution that I'm in, it changes the institution fundamentally.
Yes. Why does it change the institution fundamentally? Because the institution's tradition of Supreme Court opinions not being leaked is based on trust. The trust is broken. From now on, every time there's an opinion that is circulating, people are going to be looking over their shoulders. Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor, wrote an interesting piece on this National Review saying the progressive pro-Roe versus Wade justices could do a lot of good right now if they rebuked the leak and the illegal actions that are patently intended to intimidate justices, regardless of their vehement disagreements that they may have had with the draft. But they haven't, had they? There's a pattern here. And that is that you don't see mainstream liberals, mainstream Democrats, condemning violent, illegal behavior from people on the left. They'll talk all day about January 6th, but not a word about Antifa. They'll talk all day about January 6th, but not a word about the vandalism and the violence and the death that occurred in some of the Black Lives Matter riots. They'll talk all day long about the mass shooting in Buffalo, where a white racist engaged in targeted mass murder of black citizens. But have you heard them condemn the black-on-white violence at the shooting in Brooklyn just a month ago? Or the Waukesha, Wisconsin shooting, or excuse me, a parade riot where six people were killed and 62 were hurt when a man drove his car through a parade route. And the man, I believe his name is Daryl Brooks, had a long criminal record and a social media history filled with anti-Semitism and anti-white racism. Again, not just the left, but mainstream Democrats won't condemn that. They'll just simply look away. We've seen that right here. When you had the meltdown into anti-Semitic bigotry at the Evergreen State College, you didn't see any Democrats publicly condemning the anti-Semitism, the censorship, the preposterous fact that this was happening on a college campus, which is supposed to be open to free inquiry, freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and freedom to debate. You didn't hear politicians complain.
Governor Inslee was silent during all of that at Evergreen State College.
Yeah, and Evergreen is just, you know, about 3 miles away as the crow flies from his office. You didn't hear Democrats complaining about the anti-police riots, which resulted in dozens and dozens of Seattle police officers got hurt. They were injured. Not a single Democrat in the legislature from Seattle. Not a single Democrat on the city council or county council from Seattle. None of them complained. They just look the other way. You talk about cravenly and cowardly. And now we see the same thing going on. In fact, the White House went further. They praised and encouraged more of these demonstrations, which, again, are violating federal law. The Biden administration is responsible, through the Justice Department, of enforcing federal law. And yet they're not only not enforcing it, they are green-lighting more of it. Well, I tell you, you know, the Democrats are going to get sacked in November. And boy, I cannot wait for that. They richly deserve this. They're so cowardly. They are, again, deliberately hurting the country to try and help their political movement succeed. When your political movement relies on hurting the country, maybe you ought to think twice about whether you're involved with a good movement. But anyway, that's Ketanji Brown Jackson. Has no comment on the illegal protests outside Supreme Court justices' homes, and said she can't answer whether disclosing that, leaking that opinion by Judge Alito was a good thing or a bad thing. I can't answer that. A real profile and courage there about ready to step up to the high court.
Digging deep for the stories and opinion to start your day. It's the Social Media Sweep on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
After 2 days in the desert sun, my skin began
23 minutes after 7 o'clock. John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. This is back during that period in the 70s where it seemed that every third hit was about a horse.
See,
wildfire,
horse, no
wildfire, horse with no name.
I was going to say Wildfire's the one I remember.
Wildfire.
Wild horses.
Chestnut Mary.
Oh, yeah. You know. Rolling Stones. Yeah.
Anyway, with that said, Philip J. Vandenborg III, what do you got going to the social media world?
Republican candidate for U.S. Senate, Tiffany Smiley, posting on social media about finally, after 18 years, Department of Natural Resources in our state returning to prescribed burns to try and prevent more catastrophic mega forest fires. So she posted, year after year, we've watched western states be destroyed by catastrophic wildfires. I'm encouraged to see Washington State returning to prescribed burns as a way to maintain health of forests, natural lands, while also removing dry fuel that feeds mega fires. And she links a Spokane spokesman review story. Of course, Tiffany Smiley's from the Pasco area, Tri-Cities. Yeah. And the Spokane spokesman review story says that it's a report on, firefighters or Department of Natural Resources fire crews out in Stevens County, north of Spokane County, that did a prescribed burn. First one in 18 years since 2004. They burned 108 acres between Springdale and Loon Lake in Stevens County. And they quote the State Department of Natural Resources acting prescribed fire program manager saying, quote, we'd like to see a lot more, hundreds of thousands of acres, end quote, as it relates to these prescribed burns.
Well, why, I guess the obvious question is, why haven't we? Now, Hilary Frantz has held this job
for
6 years. Yeah. And before her, you know, again, the policy was to let it burn.
Yep. And here's part of the answer.
The accumulation of all that underbrush is what causes the ferocity and the extreme heat, and hence the size of these wildfires. That's what you need to do is improve how you clear the underbrush. Go ahead.
The spokesman story says, for 18 years, Department of Natural Resources in Washington State has not burned state lands on purpose, but in the last few years, as catastrophic megafires have become more commonplace throughout the West, state and federal agencies pushed hard to bring prescribed fires back. Many argue they're essential in order to fight wildfire and restore healthy forests. They say not all fire is bad.
So I guess that means when they've exhausted every conceivable alternative, they'll go back to doing what is obviously the right thing to do all along. Hey, when we come back, what the media, what the White House, and what Congress doesn't seem to understand about the justices and this ruling that could overturn Roe versus Wade.
Irreverent, entertaining, and unafraid. Dana Lash, The Dana Show, weekdays 6 to 9 p.m. KVI, KVI.com.
So I'm going to hurriedly jump in here so you don't have to hear any more of this song, Little Willie. Again, it was the 70s. What can I tell you? It was kind of hit and miss. On the one hand, you had Led Zeppelin and Peter Frampton, Ted Nugent. On the other hand, you had Terry Jacks, Season of the Sun, and songs like this one. Anyway.
Original guitar heroes they were, adding to the mix this week. Yeah.
If there is a song you like, just go ahead and email me, john@kvi.com. I believe we're the only show in America, the only talk radio program that takes music requests, and we've received thousands of them, and I think we have actually been able to keep almost every one of them, because a lot of you want to hear the same song. So just email me, john@kvi.com. Tell me what you want to hear, and if you want, tell me why. It might make a great story. Okay. New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd has been with the paper since the Reagan era. And she has a most recent column, Too Much Church in the State. She's taking on the U.S. Supreme Court and the likelihood that Roe versus Wade is going to be struck down. And she quotes Amy Coney Barrett during her confirmation hearings, saying the following: judges can't just wake up one day and say, I have an agenda. I like guns. I hate guns. I like abortion. I hate abortion. And walk in like a royal queen and impose their will on the world. It's not the law of Amy. It's the law of the American people. In other words, Amy Coney Barrett explaining the difference between a Supreme Court justice and a legislator. A legislator pushes things that they like. A judge interprets the Constitution according to what the Constitution says. Not what they want it to say, what the Constitution says, as further refined by case law and the history of whatever amendment or article is at issue. So anyway, here is what Maureen Dowd has to say about that quote. Yet the law of Amy, quote, seems to be coming. Like a royal queen, she will impose her will on the world. It will be the law of Amy Coney Barrett and Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas and Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. It's outrageous that five or six people in lifelong unaccountable jobs are about to impose their personal views on the rest of the country. While they will certainly provide the legal causatory for their opinion, let's not be played for fools. The Supreme Court's impending repeal of Roe will be owed to more than judicial argumentation. Okay. Let's assume two things. Let's assume that Amy Coney Barrett and Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas, Neil Gorsuch, Brett Kavanaugh, let's assume they're all pro-life. Let's assume they're pro-life. Don't know that. But it's an assumption that everybody else is making. So I tell you what, for purposes of argument, I'll make it two. Let's pretend that's the case. All right. If they wanted to impose pro-life values, then what they would be doing in the Dobbs case would be overturning Roe versus Wade and replacing it with a doctrine that every living being with a heartbeat in America is deserving protection of the law. And because of that, no more abortion. And just as Roe swung a meat cleaver through 50 state statutes on abortion, let's say, you know, if the justices really wanted to impose pro-life values, that's what they would be doing here. And it's, again, not up to the states. It's not up to elected legislators. It's up to us justices. From now on, since Roe did nationalize the abortion issue, we're going to nationalize it. Every being with a heartbeat, including a fetus, is entitled to the full protection of the law. No more abortion once a heartbeat can be detected. Now, that would be imposing your pro-life views on the rest of the country. But that's not what the Samuel Alito opinion does. What the Alito opinion does is says, constitutionally speaking, Roe was a mistake from the start. There's nothing in the Constitution about abortion. Certainly nothing in case law. There's nothing in the historic record. Nothing, no historic document, no debate that suggests how people were thinking about abortion back then. So, if the Constitution is silent on the issue, then that means it is up to elected officials to decide. There's nothing, for instance, in the Constitution about assisted suicide, or, if you will, life-ending care. Okay? So you leave it up to elected officials. That's how the concept of federalism works. Where if there's nothing in any of the seven articles of the Constitution, nothing in any of the 27 amendments about a particular issue, then the power to decide goes to elected representatives. Now, you can argue about whether it should be federal or state or local. But again, what the justices are saying is, in the Alito opinion, it's not up to unelected judges. So this isn't about abortion. It's about how the Constitution and government in a free republic is supposed to work. If they wanted to impose abortion, if they wanted to do a reverse Roe versus Wade, if they really wanted to completely reverse it, then they would simply keep a national standard and would substitute pro-life values for pro-choice, pro-abortion rights values. But they didn't do that. You know why, Maureen Dowd of the New York Times? Because they weren't trying to impose their views about abortion. There's nothing in the Alito opinion that says, here's when life begins. There's nothing in the Alito opinion that says, here's when abortion should be illegal. What the Alito opinion says is, here's who should make the decision. There are some states that have abortion laws that are so liberal, they're so macabre, that they allow abortion up to the moment of birth. That's beyond radical. That's ghoulish. It's scary that a grown, educated adult with a sense of when life begins would allow a 9-month-old fetus to be killed. A fetus that could live outside the womb can be killed as long as you keep it inside the womb when you're killing it. That's, again, that to me, that's just gruesome. But the Alito opinion doesn't prohibit that. There's nothing in Washington's very liberal abortion law that is prohibited by a single word in the Alito opinion. The only thing that they are doing is reiterating that the decision on what abortion law should look like in Washington state and in every state should be made by elected officials who are accountable to the public. And guess what? Washington voters have actually been living by the Alito decision since before Roe versus Wade. Roe versus Wade did not have any impact on Washington state abortion law. That is because 3 years before then, in 1970, the voters of Washington state went to the polls and liberalized our state's abortion law. And then, in a very controversial initiative that just barely passed in 1991, voters further liberalized abortion in Washington state. So Washington's never relied on Roe versus Wade. And eventually, voters here in Washington and in many of the other states, particularly those that are pro-choice, are going to figure this out. Hey, this opinion doesn't have any significance or impact on our state's law. No, because the law was made by elected officials. I guarantee you, at least some of those Supreme Court justices don't like Washington's law or Oregon's or Virginia's or New York's or California's. I guarantee you that. But they're not striking it down. You know why? Because they're not trying to impose their views about abortion. They're trying to make the Constitution coherent again.
I'd like to teach the world to sing with me.
Insights, not algorithms. Talk Radio 570 KVI.
Oh, this reminds me of the Mad Men finale. Just a brilliant
the TV show, Mad Men.
Yeah. All the things we think of with these Carlson cartoons.
All right, welcome back, everybody, to the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Let's run Joel Moreno's story about the controversy up in Marysville about whether schools should be allowed to have clubs without not only requiring parental permission, but without even notifying parents what their kid's doing. Have a listen.
Joining an after-school club becomes a flashpoint. This family split over a plan to require parental consent at some Marysville schools. The issue arose when teachers started a safe space meeting for LGBTQ students and district leaders moved to limit access. And this video shows a group gathered outside that board meeting showing support for those clubs. KMOS Joel Marino's live in Marysville tonight with a community turnout that may have postponed the big vote. Joel?
Mary, most expected a final decision tonight, but the public comment, it was so divided, the legal ramifications so unclear that the parental consent policy was modified but not yet adopted. Families lined up alongside teachers ahead of the meeting, united in their opposition to a plan by the school board to require that parents sign off on their child joining a school club.
Of course, we want parents to be involved in their students' lives, but reality, that's not always there.
Well, I tell you what, parents' wills should not be contradicted by school officials in cases like this. We'll be talking about this more. This subject's going to be percolating.
You found it, the best place for live, local, conservative talk in the morning. The Commute with Carlson. Stimulating, entertaining, and making a difference. Here's John Carlson on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
6 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, in the John Carlson Show, hour number three of the radio program of record, coming your way. Of course, we will take your phone calls. Again, extra leeway latitude on your phone calls, the final hour of the show, which just began. So go ahead, give us a shout at 206-421-5757. That is 206-421-5757, outside King County, 888-312-5757. Yesterday, we talked about the horror of the awful terrorist attacks, one at a church in Southern California, one person killed, five people wounded. It could have been so, so much worse. We'll tell you why. Coming up in a few minutes. And then, of course, the mass murder at the Tops grocery store in Buffalo, where you had 13 people shot, 10 of them killed, 8 of them African-American. Why do I bring up race? Because that appears to be the motive for the shooter, whose name I don't like to mention. As you know, I'm one of those who has a policy of playing down the identity of these shooters, lest they get their goal of becoming famous. And what we are hearing, again, this is very unfortunate to see this, but these are the times we're living in. Immediately, when it became clear that it was a young white assailant with racist views killing these people for the crime of shopping in a grocery store. I mean, it's so hideously cruel and cowardly. There were attempts by the media and political establishment to blame Tucker Carlson and Fox News and conservatives because they keep talking about something called the Great Replacement Theory. And this guy in his rambling 180-page manifesto mentions the Great Replacement Theory. Now, if you look at the manifesto, I haven't read the whole thing. It's 180 pages. I've seen excerpts of it. Here is what it is. It's a rambling, politically incoherent mess. I mean, the shooter says that he's a fascist, but also that he's a left-wing environmentalist. He does mention Fox News in the manifesto, but only to criticize them and dismiss them. So, oops, there goes the anti-Tucker Carlson angle. The manifesto is, again, it's political in that he's talking about political issues, but he's just all over the map. And Kyle Smith in this morning's nationalreview.com said it kind of is like the Unabomber's manifesto. It's just rambling and barely coherent, which, by the way, would seem to correspond with the idea that this guy is mentally ill. You know, the authorities got it right the first time when he threatened to shoot up his school and he was hospitalized. But then after a day and a half, they went, oh, I guess, you know, he was just blowing off steam. And they released him from the hospital, didn't charge him with anything. And what do you know? He went out and bought a gun. But what I thought you'd want to hear, you've probably been hearing for maybe the first time ever, the Great Replacement Theory. And the way it's being talked about on, you know, MSNBC and CNN and on the floor of the House of Representatives by Democratic members of the House is that if you're concerned about the cultural and political fallout of illegal immigration, then you're talking about the Great Replacement Theory, and that makes you part of this killer's milieu. This means you're in tandem with a racist mass murderer. Is that really the case? Well, I tell you what. Ben Shapiro, the author, editor, and creator of The Daily Wire, has a wonderful short explanation. What is the Great Replacement Theory? And what is the difference between what it is and what the media are talking about? Here, have a listen.
The Great Replacement Theory is the theory that essentially there are a bunch of Jewish elites, and this coterie of Jewish elites wishes to pervert the racial stock of a country like the United States, a predominantly white country, in order to weaken the country from within. That is the Great Replacement Theory. It is not concerns about illegal immigration. It is not concerns about cultural assimilation. The Great Replacement Theory is the idea there can never be cultural assimilation. The Great Replacement Theory is the idea that racism, that race is destiny. In fact, the racial essentialism of Great Replacement Theory looks a lot more like wokeism than it does like mainstream conservatism or mainstream liberalism. Neither of the two major Democratic parties is a believer that simply because you are of a particular race, this means that you are inherently genetically designed in order to vote a particular way. That is relegated to the wokest left, and it's relegated to the white supremacist right, who sort of join hands in this belief that we can look at your race and know inherently how you are going to vote and how your kids are going to vote and how your grandkids are going to vote. But basic concerns over illegal immigration and how that shifts voting patterns, that is not the Great Replacement Theory. Concerns about whether new immigrants to the United States are going to assimilate to the American way of life, that's not the Great Replacement Theory. So what the left is trying to do is take the classical great replacement theory, a neo-Nazi white supremacist theory, and then conflate that with all these other normal concerns and then say, if you have those concerns, you are part of the movement that led to this mass shooting in Buffalo, New York.
Yeah, it's Ben Shapiro, and he says it quite well. There actually is such a thing called great replacement theory, and it's a lunatic conspiracy theory involving Jews. But Ben also pointed out something very important, and that is that the far left and the far right, meaning the lunatic left and the lunatic right, they actually have something in common here. They believe in racial politics. They believe that race is destiny in politics. They believe, both the left and the right in this country, believe that Martin Luther King had it wrong. That America is not a country where you should be judged by the content of your character rather than the color of your skin. Both the far left and the far right in this country believe that your race, your color, is your destiny. It does define you. And, of course, same with gender, but particularly when it comes to race. Race always tops gender. So, this theory does exist. But what you're hearing on all these chat shows is not great replacement theory. What you're hearing them say, the Joy Reids of this world, the Lawrence O'Donnells of this world, what they are saying is that if you talk about the rather obvious cultural fallout from rampant illegal immigration or the political fallout, that, oh, you're indulging in great replacement theory conversation. No, that's not what the great replacement theory is. And I will point out that it's the Democrats who have been talking about racially changing America's political map for years. You know, how many years have Democrats been saying, oh, it's just a matter of time before Texas becomes a blue state, because Texas is getting browner. And as Texas gets browner, Texas gets bluer. Again, they're extrapolating that because Hispanics traditionally prefer Democrats rather than Republicans, that they will vote Democrat. And as more Hispanics move into Texas, that means more and more of Texas becomes blue. Nice theory. It's not working. It's not working because, gee, what do you know? Race isn't destiny. A surprising number of Hispanics in Texas prefer the Republicans. Law-abiding Latino voters, they don't like open borders. They don't like illegal immigration. They don't like the quality of life that they have worked for and paid for to be ruined by the government looking the other way while coyotes are smuggling drugs and people and who knows what else across the border, and they're not stopped. I mentioned a month ago that there are four Hispanic women running for Congress in border areas of Texas. They're all Republican. So what we are seeing is, gee, what do you know? People just don't vote. You know, their race doesn't dictate how they vote after all. They actually make up their own minds. And in Texas, Hispanics are voting very different from how Hispanics are voting in, say, East Los Angeles. It's easy to see. It's easy to track. Just as Hispanics in Little Havana tend to prefer Republicans. So, That is what's wrong with the Democrats' take on racial politics. They're still pushing it. And here's my take, very simply. You're hearing about the dangers of white nationalism. Yeah, white nationalism is dangerous. Do you know why white nationalism is dangerous? Because any kind of racial nationalism is dangerous. Anytime you put your race ahead of your country, you are fundamentally undermining the progress that this country has made. One nation, under God, indivisible. So, just something to bear in mind. You know, the motto of America, E Pluribus Unum, is not out of one nation, many people. It's precisely the opposite. Out of many people, one nation, one creed, one rule of law that all should abide by.
Checking the pulse of politics every hour on The Commute with Carlson. It's the Social Media Sweep on Talk Radio 570 KVI.
Not just any social media sweep, but Philip J.'s favorite segment of the day, Social Media from Socialists. He's got all sorts of stuff packed away, so let's go to him early. Philip J. Van Orton, okay. What do you got?
Yeah, here's one from a Shama Sawant sycophant in Seattle, a guy named Brett Hamill. Portrays himself as a cartoonist and on social media. He posted about the Seattle Police Department. He posted, "You'd have a hard time changing the culture of people who write SpongeBob fan fiction. Much less an armed group that leans authoritarian, acts with impunity, has absolute power of life and death over its subjects, and has successfully gamed the accountability system for decades. There's one more. I got to find the second part of his tweet here. But first off, he's kind of talking about the Seattle Police Department as change of culture, but at one point, before the anti-police protests and riots broke out in Seattle in 2020, Seattle Police Department was basically in compliance with the consent decree, and then the defund police movement started up.
Yeah.
And so Brett Hamill adds, changing the culture of an incredibly entrenched accountability-averse, overtly hostile organization like the Seattle Police Department really seems way more difficult than just firing a bunch of bad employees. And I just find it a little odd that he's complaining about accountability averse. And look at the repeat offenders that we have in Seattle and the criminal justice system that is accountability averse of repeat criminals in Seattle, and how people like Pete Holmes, the old Seattle city attorney, have influenced that.
Here's my take. If any of you out there have the same view of police officers that Mr. Hamill here has, then when someone breaks into your home or someone attacks you and a member of your household, mm-hmm. don't call 911. Don't call the cops. Don't be a hypocrite.
That would be the consistent thing to do.
If that's how you feel about police officers, then walk your talk for once. Don't call 911. Handle it yourself. You don't want to contribute to this irresponsible use of tyrannical force by the police department, do you? Next time you get mugged, next time someone breaks into your house, handle it yourself.
The Progressive Agenda in Itty Bitty Pieces. Ari Hoffman, weekdays 3 to 6. KVI, KVI.com.
Down for so long, and Lord, it's getting cold.
The rumors are not true that I supplied the harmonica overplay here.
That's one for you to learn. Put it on your list.
But this is...
It'll be
a hit.
Do
you recognize the voice, radio legend Mark Christopher?
Yeah, I do. It's because our little friend here, our big friend here, Phil, was one of the first to buy the album of Ray Bingham, which...
Ryan Bingham. But yeah.
Ryan.
Yep.
What did I say? Rim?
You said Ray.
Ray.
But you're like three-fifths of the way there, what, four-thirds of the way there?
He's still the new artist in my category, but to everybody, you know him as Walker on Yellowstone. The guy that was brought in from the prison to work on the ranch.
He's a ranch hand on Yellowstone.
Yeah. And he's an actual recording artist. His album is really catching on. He's getting a lot of hits online due to his character and the popularity of the series.
Yeah. It must have been...
By the way, he's not a real ex-con. That's just a role he played on TV.
He was asked, actually, just to provide music for the show. And then Taylor Sheridan said, you know what? Let's just put a role together. I don't know how long it'll last. I'll probably have to kill you off eventually, but... You know, you'll get to know what...
That's acting.
You know, the train station, you'll get to know what that means.
Your character's going to get killed.
That's right.
And I only stumbled across this. I didn't realize that the actor in the show is actually not famous for being an actor. He's famous for being this guitarist, singer, musician.
Yeah.
Because I heard a song that I thought was fantastic in an episode of Yellowstone. And I kind of did some sleuthing on the internet. And the song is called Bread and Water by Ryan Bingham. Just an excellent song, and from there I tracked down CDs and picked up more of his songs, and I'm really enjoying his music. I've been listening to it a fair amount here in the last 3 or 4 months.
Okay,
what's the title of that song?
That last one?
Yeah.
Mark had it.
That was like the...
Something in Water?
South Side of Heaven is what I played.
That was what Mark played, but the song I'm talking about that got me to figure out that this actor is actually a... not an actor so much as he's a musician, guitarist. That was Bread and Water.
Okay.
Bread and Water.
Okay, so we have a lot of our listeners that are big fans of Yellowstone, John.
Yes, I know. Well, that's the unofficial, not the official, but the unofficial television show of the John Carlson program is Yellowstone. Yeah. We love Yellowstone.
It'd be fun to get you on the show somehow. They need a talk show host to
every single...
John could be a campaign consultant for somebody running for governor in Montana. That's your walk-on role.
Right. Hey, you never know. Go ahead, John.
We got to be creative.
Well, every single person who has a role on the show who is from Montana, not some interloper who's moved in from Connecticut, but to do some fly fishing. But every Montana resident on the show, I'm convinced, A, votes R, votes red, or B, doesn't vote at all.
Could be.
I love this show. And I love Taylor Sheridan. He made another great series called 1883, which is actually the prequel to Yellowstone.
So,
and they're both just outstanding.
We got the scoop here on the Carlson Commute, everybody. And I got the call late last night on this. So you've been wondering about season 5. Some of the cast members were saying early April they hadn't seen any scripts. They were worried it was going to be just sacked. No room for season 5. They finally got a script. They started filming in Montana yesterday. Season 5, cast members are all there, ready to roll. Taylor Sheridan saying because of Season 5 and what they've already got planned, saying expect a lot of surprises, oh wows, a lot of lefts, a lot of rights, going up and down in the script. Most of the seasons 1 through 4, John, as you know, have been 10 episodes.
Yeah.
Taylor Sheridan right now saying we cannot do Season 5 for less than 14 episodes.
Less than 14, okay.
They're planning on a fall release on Paramount Plus, weather permitting. They ran into snow last year for season 4, but it's a go. They're going to make it happen here.
Okay.
And just real quick, on 1883, it looks like they're shutting it down for a season 2. They're going to make a couple of episodes here and there and just kind of put them on Paramount Plus just to kind of
make a movie.
Just make a movie.
Actually, that's not a bad idea.
The movie would be good, but they said maybe 2 episodes here and there just to kind of toss it in and maybe give a break to Yellowstone as they get the 14 episodes on air this fall. So
hype up with a movie, and you could either put it in theaters or put it in theaters and stream it and use that to kind of tie people over until you get to another complete season of the prequel.
So here's somebody who isn't getting ready for another season. Are you guys following the story of former Seahawks superstar Earl Thomas?
I had just heard he got into more legal trouble here over the weekend.
Yes, ouch.
Earl Thomas, let's set the table here. 7-time Pro Bowler, was probably despite his very angry departure from the Seattle Seahawks a couple of years ago, was probably destined for the Ring of Honor. He may have been the best safety in football and the most talented member of Seattle's Legion of Boom. But he's always had a prickly personality, and he's always just a little odd. And, you know, it was laid out really well by Matt Calkins in the Seattle Times. Here he was, Super Bowl champ, all-pro safety, a beautiful new bride, a $40 million contract, 4-0. And despite being the most highly paid safety in the NFL, whined all the time. Remember this? I'm being disrespected. And then he wanted the Seahawks to extend his contract when he already had 2 years to go on his current contract. And that's against Seahawk policy. Pete Carroll, the general manager, John Schneider, have never extended a player who had more than a year remaining on his contract. But Thomas threw temper tantrums and sat out practices. This goes back to 2018. And then when he did get on the field and play, in his final game as a Seahawk, he broke his leg. And as he was being carted off the field, remember this? It was such a low moment. He flipped off Pete Carroll.
Yeah.
As he was being
carted off. The sideline, I guess.
Remember that?
Yeah, he extended the middle finger. Yeah.
So we did not keep him. But because he was so insanely talented, the Baltimore Ravens signed him to a 4-year deal the following year, 2019. $55 million. So that's now $95 million for being a great football player. But he didn't play beyond 2019. He punched one of his teammates at practice. They released him for, quote, personal conduct that has adversely affected the Baltimore Ravens. Here's the indicator, you guys. No team has signed him since. The Dallas Texans were considering it, but after several players on the team complained and said they didn't want him on the squad.
Now, you said the Dallas Texans. Did you mean the Cowboys or the Houston Texans?
No, the Houston Texans.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Houston Texans.
That's right. Dallas Cowboys, Houston Texans.
And there was a point in time where Earl Thomas was making public locker room statements or to the Dallas Cowboys, come and get me, as in come and sign me or come and trade for me from Seattle. He is a Texas guy, wanted to play in his home state.
It was worse than that. He again played his college football, his high school and college football in Texas. It was University of Texas Longhorn. And after a Seahawk Cowboy game, he approached their former coach and said, come get me. Which is just stunning that you would say that after you're playing a game against them as an opponent. Anyway, this is someone who's on self-destruct mode. And now he's arrested, as you probably heard, violating a court protective order. He allegedly sent threatening messages to his ex-wife about her and their children. He's facing third-degree felony charges for multiple violations. His ex has told police he has sent texts saying that he had obtained two handguns, and another text saying that he would, quote, kick her ass, close quote. Okay, now some of you might say, huh, Richard Sherman had, you know, a similar problem. There was one big difference here. Richard Sherman was talking about hurting himself. Richard Sherman was in personal distress. Earl Thomas was apparently menacing his ex-wife. Kind of a difference. Richard Sherman's wife was saying, protect Richard from himself. Earl Thomas's ex-wife was saying, protect me from him. So that's where he is right now. And, you know, I'll tell you what it goes to show. You know, let this be a lesson for all of us, particularly you young people out there. He has talent. He has much more money than he ever thought he would have. He's got a family. And it's not enough.
And he's at the point where his playing career is winding down, and this is going to drastically limit the possible prospects for his employment in the future, too.
Yeah.
That's one of the other aspects here. Going forward, just going forward, how this behavior is impacting what happens for the rest of his life.
Well, this guy needs a major adjustment in his attitude toward everything. I mean, he just needs a fundamental attitude shift. This is someone who does not understand or appreciate how insanely lucky and fortunate he is in so many ways.
Yeah, I
Instead,
mean...
He's always looking at what he doesn't have.
Yeah.
Here he was, you know, multimillionaire safety, 2 years left on this contract that paid him $40 million, and all he could do was think about, why won't you extend me? I have 2 years left on my contract. Why aren't you extending me? And the response from the Seahawks, we never do that, and we never have done that. Mm-hmm. Well, if you don't, then I may not show up for practice. Again, talk about self-sabotage. So, yes, we're not a sports station, but there is a universal lesson here that goes way beyond sports. If you don't have the right attitude toward God, your fellow man, the people in your life, then money ain't going to make you happier. Fame is not going to make you happier. Talent ain't going to do it. And so, you know, what Matt Calkin suggests is, you know, maybe Earl Thomas needs to focus on people who had it all, threw it all away, and managed to come back and enjoy a modicum of success. You know, he mentions Michael Vick and Ryan Leaf, Spencer Haywood, who's is in that HBO series, basketball series right now. Spencer Haywood had a terrible drug problem, and, you know, he came back from it all. But anyway, I wish the best or Earl Thomas, but right now, cautionary lesson really is.
Got a pocket full of sunshine, I got a love, and I know that it's all mine. Oh, do what you want, but you're never gonna break me.
We stand at attention and salute our military, police, and first responders. Talk Radio 570 KVI.
Listening to the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI Seattle and KPLZ HD3 Seattle. You can hear us in HD if your car allows it. So, Pete Ducey is the Fox News White House correspondent. And yesterday, Jen Psaki, who has made it official, instead of giving MSNBC talking points from the White House podium as press spokesman for the president, she now gives MSNBC talking points from the studios of MSNBC. She has left Joe Biden. By the way, good move, Jen. You made it just before the Titanic hits the iceberg in November, starts sinking, and makes way for Karine Jean-Pierre, who is making a big deal over the fact that she is an African-American woman who is also lesbian. And she is calling attention to this as, you know, I guess, you know, the Jackie Robinson of White House spokespeople. So anyway, yesterday was her first day on the job, and Pete Ducey asked her a very simple question. See,
President,
what do you think of her answer?
Twitter. The president's Twitter account posted the other day, you want to bring down inflation, let's make sure the wealthiest corporations pay their fair share. Mm-hmm. How does raising taxes on corporations reduce inflation?
Are you talking about a specific tweet?
He tweeted, you want to bring down inflation, let's make sure the wealthiest corporations pay their fair share.
Look, you know, we have talked about this past year about making sure that the wealthiest among us are paying their fair share, and that is important to do, and that is something that the president has been working on every day when we talk about inflation and lowering costs, and so it's very important that as we're seeing costs rise, as we're talking about how to build America that's safe, that's equal for everyone and doesn't leave everyone behind. That is an important part of that as well.
But how does raising taxes on corporations lower the cost of gas, the cost of a used car, the cost of food for everyday Americans?
So look, I think we encourage those who have done very well, right, especially those who care about climate change, to support a fair tax code that doesn't charge manufacturers, workers, cops, builders a higher percentage of their earnings, that the most fortunate people in our nation, and not let that stand in the way of reducing energy costs and fighting this existential problem, if you think about that as an example, and to support basic collective bargaining rights as well, right? That's also important. But look, it is, by not, okay, without having a fair tax code, which is what I'm talking about, then all manufacturing workers, cops, it's not fair.
It's good
for
to
them
know that that's
to
what she's talking
pay
about.
Higher taxes than the folks that who are not paying taxes at all.
But what does that have to do with inflation? The president said, "You want to bring down inflation? Let's make sure the wealthiest corporations pay their fair share."
Right. Yeah. I mean, he never got an answer, and you didn't hear one either.
Did she compare?
What you saw?
Did she compare police officers and manufacturing workers at one point?
Yeah, no. She look. If you the video.
Oh yeah.
She's answering this question while she's hurriedly paging through her briefing book, looking for a lily pad to land on.
Yeah, she's looking at those notes, and she's just trying to read whatever's on the page that is incoherent, basically.
This is what happens when you don't understand the first thing about economics. I mean, not ready for prime time. I mean, the problem with what Karine Jean-Pierre was saying is that it was a complete evasion to a perfectly reasonable question. The president made a connection between raising taxes and bringing down inflation. And Pete Ducey simply said, what's the connection? How does raising taxes on anybody affect the inflation rate? And then you just heard, I believe that clip ran about a minute 45.
It's like right under 2 minutes.
Yeah. Of complete meandering. Just all over
so
the place. Yeah. Okay. And so, how did she get the job? If you want to be a White House press spokesperson, how do you get the job? Well, Karine Jean-Pierre worked for a group called MoveOn.org. That's not a liberal group. That is a left-wing group. In 2016, Karine Jean-Pierre questioned whether or not Donald Trump really won the 2016 race for president. Back then, it was okay to question the winner of a presidential election. In 2018, she falsely said that Stacey Abrams was robbed of the governorship in Georgia. She wasn't. Stacey Abrams, who was a Democratic state representative, was defeated by 50,000 votes. Okay, she lost by more than four times as many votes as Donald Trump lost Georgia. Donald Trump was called a sore loser. Stacey Abrams was celebrated for refusing to concede and defiantly say, I did not lose this race. The left, not just the left, the Democratic Party praised Stacey Abrams for doing what they condemned Donald Trump for doing, but Donald Trump had a much better case to make. Now, I don't believe that Trump did win Georgia. Wish he had, but I don't think he did. He lost by about 11,000 votes. But Stacey Abrams clearly didn't win Georgia. She's running again. She's going to lose this time by far more than 50,000 votes. But after questioning the election of Donald, the legitimacy of Donald Trump's election, and the legitimacy of Governor Kemp's election in Georgia, she goes on and gets a position with the Biden administration. And they bring her in. Do I need to tell you what her most prominent qualifications were for the position? Well, they clearly aren't her command of issues. You just kind of heard. Again, it's because this White House can't get beyond pandering on the issue of race, on the issue of sexual orientation, on the issue of gender. They can't get it out of their system.
And Jeff Bezos pounced on this Joe Biden tweet that Pete Ducey was asking about at the White House press conference. Here's what the Joe Biden Twitter account posted last Friday.
Right.
Here's the post. You want to bring down inflation? Question mark. Let's make sure the wealthiest corporations pay their fair share. Bezos responded, the newly created disinformation board should review this tweet. Or maybe they need to form a new non-sequitur board instead. Ooh. Raising corporate taxes is fine to discuss. Taming inflation's critical to discuss. Mushing them together is just misdirection. So Jeff Bezos was having none of it. Then the White House responded, it doesn't require a huge leap to figure out why one of the wealthiest individuals on earth opposes an economic agenda for the middle class that cuts some of the biggest costs families face, fights inflation for the long haul, and adds to the historic deficit reduction President Biden is achieving by asking the richest taxpayers and corporations to pay their fair share. And Bezos responds to that by posting, look, a squirrel. This is the White House's statements about my recent tweets. They understandably want to muddy the topic. They know inflation hurts right. The neediest the most, but unions aren't causing inflation, and neither are wealthy people.
Well,
checkmate.
Like, again, Jeff Bezos has the advantage of understanding rudimentary, elementary economics. And all we see from the other side is, again, misdirection. That is the perfect word to use. You get clear direction coming up from our friends Mark Lee Van Camp and Robbins right in front of us here.
Are you ready?